God.
Yeah?
No, it actually began as a drinking song.
Oh, yeah?
Doesn't just hearing it make you wish you weren't sober?
Oh, yeah?
Oh, you mean,
yes.
Its author, Francis Scott Key, might have been charmed by topping the top 40, but was this really what he had in mind?
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so pleased to have M.K. Serwick joining us via telephone from Lake Michigan area, right, M.K.?
Yes, Lakeside, Michigan, Southwest Michigan.
So Southwest Michigan, Lakeside.
Yes.
That sounds like such an idyllic place to be.
It is pretty nice.
I hope you have a breeze today, because we're into the summer now here. well, MK, welcome, and thanks for being game to talk via phone today about we're going to talk about a lot of your work. And the occasion, though, like why you suddenly came into my orbit here, was your book, your Will Eisner award-winning book, Menopause, A Comic Treatment, that you edited and one of your comics is featured in. Thanks for making a book like this.
Oh, it's wonderful to hear you say that.
I bet I'm not the first. I bet a lot of people come up to you and express that.
Yes, there's a certain look on someone's face when you know that they're really resonating with the content.
My friend, the Liz, who was a longtime engineer of Living Writers here, she's the one that told me about your book. She saw it in her local bookstore in D.C. and said she kept walking by it and it kept like looking at her. And then I told her about a project on perimenopause that I'm doing now, making a zine. And she's like, you got to get this book. You got to talk to this M.K. Serwick. So here we are. That's our little origin story for the day. Before we get too much further, before we start talking, M.K., I'll read your bio in the back of Menopause, A Comic Treatment. M.K. Serwick is a nurse, cartoonist, educator, and co-founder of the field of graphic medicine. She is the creator of Taking Turns, Stories from HIV/AIDS Care Unit 371, and a co-author of Graphic Medicine Manifesto. M.K. is also the comics editor for the journal Literature and Medicine. She regularly teaches graphic medicine at Northwestern University's Feinberg Medical School and the University of Chicago. M.K. has served as a senior fellow of the George Washington School of Nursing Center for Health Policy and Media Engagement, as well as a Will Eisner Fellow in Applied Cartooning at the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction, Vermont. You can check out more of her work at her website, comicnurse.com. M.K., so let's start with Menopause, A Comic Treatment. How did this book come into being for you? Because it seems like it might have been a natural outgrowth of work that you were doing in health and medicine and art. But why this book?
Yeah, so I'm a nurse and a cartoonist. And as you mentioned, I was kind of... I helped co-found this field called graphic medicine, which looks at the intersection of healthcare and the medium of comics as a way to communicate information, share our experiences, et cetera, et cetera. And I was, while doing that work, starting to experience all of the, the cascade of things that happen in perimenopause. And I thought, well, I'm going to turn to the medium that I love and that I work in and see what's out there about menopause in comic form. And as I say in the introduction to the text, everything I found was just incredibly insulting to women.
Yes, often.
I share one panel from a comic that was the only other book of comics about menopause, and it's a man leaving his wife, saying that she's crying too much, and he's going to his mother. And that was from an anthology by someone named a cartoonist named Nora Preddy, and they were single panel New Yorker style comics. But every one of them was just so insulting. If women weren't being judged and deemed an inconvenience to the men around them, it was women judging one another and saying, and again, this was the 1950s, you know, you haven't had your surgery yet, that's the problem, or you're not taking your pills, or it was all just terrible. And I thought, we have got to do better than this.
And that was the 50s, so in that
right.
time period. And then it seems like there's a quiet time. We had some texts like Gail, there's been some things, but not a lot in our culture until the last, 10 years or so, where it seems like more things are coming, like more people are at least starting to write about it, and hopefully medical science will follow.
Right. I think that part of it is because most research in medicine is actually, and we're becoming more aware of this now, not conducted on women or with women. Shouldn't say on women. It's not being conducted with women in the populations that are researched, like just as a matter of course for medications and all the things that make medicine research-based. A lot of times women aren't even involved in those studies. And so it makes sense that something that like this is not really covered. And of course, being a nurse, I was like extra sort of surprised how little I knew, because I am a nurse, right? I should have been taught this in nursing school, and I think it wasn't really ever addressed. And so, and actually about a year before this book came out, there actually was an article in the New Yorker that said, "Where are all the books on menopause?"
Exactly. Yes. And that one was by Sarah Manguso.
Ah, yeah.
Right. And 2019, for women, aging is framed as a series of losses of fertility, of sexuality, of beauty, but it can be a liberation too. That's the tagline under the article. Yeah.
Right. And it is exciting though, because you're right. I was very grateful that kind of we were in this new kind of generation of books that are coming out now that are, I think, really wonderful.
And but then for you, when you were looking out there, it seemed like, because in the world, when you're a cartoonist, when you're a comics maker, you were having an expanding world of a community of people, definitely with the community that you were creating with the Graphic Medicine Manifesto. But even, I would say, for your book, Taking Turns, Alison Bechtel was one of the folks who blurbed your book there. So you're in this comics and cartoonist community as well. And so you're thinking, maybe, what do these women think? Or what do these folks think about this time? And how are we drawing it?
That's absolutely right. I was fortunate enough that I was in a position, because of the work I was doing, to know and have personal relationships with a lot of cartoonists who I thought, what would they do? Like, have they ever created on this? And so I got the opportunity to work with people that I've been in this topic on, that I've been working with in other areas. And there's also, I have to give a shout out, there's a wonderful organization out of the UK called Ladies Do Comics. and it's wonderful. And I had been going to meetings, and some of the people in there, in the book, my anthology, are from that community as well.
Can you talk a little bit about how you created the anthology, Menopause, a Comic Treatment?
Yeah, I kind of sent out I generated a list of people that I wanted to ask if they were interested, rather than just putting a general call, because I wanted to make sure that what I got was within the parameters of what I was looking for. And what I was looking for was a wide range of experiences. So there are a number of reasons that people have experienced menopause and the symptoms associated with it that aren't necessarily related to the age, their age, right? So surgical menopause means that you've had some surgery that makes your body go into menopause, or gender transition, or, you know, there's other reasons people are, or chemotherapy sometimes will have those impacts. And so I wanted to make sure that I covered those areas, and I had particular artists who I knew were in those different situations that I appealed to. And then, of course, I wanted to make sure it was representational of different communities and different cultural experiences, and different visual styles as well. And so those are kind of some of the things I was looking for, perspective and life experience that would be varied to give as wide of a view of this experience as possible.
So you sent out emails, MK, to folks, and what happened? Is that how you did it? And then what happened? You know, can you give a story of sort of what was the response like, and who wrote back first? Or
yeah. Oh, that's a good question. I think people were the people that I wrote to were generally very enthusiastic and really wanted to be a part of it. A few of the pieces that are in there I had seen elsewhere, and I wanted to find out if I could reproduce them as part of this collection. So in that case, it was about them being excited about it and getting the rights to it. But for the most part, people were super enthusiastic. And what was kind of crazy was that by the time this book was coming out, we were in the beginnings of COVID, or, you know, as we were getting ready for a book launch, suddenly it was COVID and we were all in lockdown. And that gave us an opportunity to create a virtual book launch, which was appropriate because the creators involved in this were from such far locations, no one could ever be in one room at one time.
Right.
So we created a video to kind of represent the launch of this book, which is available on my website.
And so when the folks, I love that you say that, and that's comicsnurse.com. For folks to go check out on the website. And so people were enthusiastic. Why do you think that is? Maybe what did you feel about it? Because did it connect to your own reason for wanting to make the book?
Absolutely. Because, you know, what I had told them was my mission of, like, why don't we know this? And also, I think particularly I was thinking about the fact that often the issues that come up, like in that comic example I described, are couched as if this is a individual problem.
Right.
It's a one person's problem, right? And as if you're the only person going through this, and you should keep it quiet and you shouldn't talk about it. No one wants to say or hear the word menopause. And I wanted to address those topics of stigma and shame. And I wanted to create community and empowerment around this topic where, you know, what I said clearly in the call was it can be funny, but we are not the butt of the joke. And the goal is to create community.
Yes. Yes. And other people felt that way, too, clearly, in what was created and what was shared. Yeah. So and how did you decide to structure it? Too, like with when you were making the arc of the movement, MK,
yeah.
Can you remember? Because I know it is. So wait, this was published in, was it 2020? Because it is.
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I know, and it's, we're 2024 now. But when you were putting it together as an editor too. I mean, it's not your first rodeo because you did. You were a co-creator, co-editor of the Graphic Medicine Manifesto, working with a group of folks.
Right, right.
But here, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say that I think that I really left a lot of that to my editor at the press, at Penn State University Press, or Graphic Mundi, which is an imprint of Penn State University Press. They were very enthusiastic about publishing it. My editor was going through all this herself and was happy to share talking about that. And so I left that to her expertise in terms of once I'd gotten all the comics and we had agreed on which ones were part of the collection, I kind of handed that over to them to edit. And I was really grateful because they're very good at the art of the book and making sure it would be attractive. And so I knew that they had the expertise in that I didn't. So I deferred to them in terms of the order that they went in.
Oh, okay. And then, but of course, like then would you see it, you saw the arc and felt like it was representing the story that you'd wanted to tell too.
Absolutely.
And how did you choose which one you wanted to put in, MK? And could you read it for us? Or
yeah, I actually don't. I have a copy of it in front of me, but I can remember exactly what it is. And basically, my comic talks about this idea of, like, so early on in getting hot flashes, particularly like during the night, I kind of tried to adopt this attitude of kind of fascination as opposed to agitation. So I would sort of be fascinated with this phenomena that my body was doing that I had, you know, no involvement in whatsoever. I couldn't predict. It was something, you know, akin to like during adolescence where your body just starts doing things, right? And I sort of became fascinated with this idea of hot flashes, like, what is the point of them? Why does our body do this? And so I wanted to talk to someone who I thought might have some ideas. I talked to a neurologist because obviously it's involved with hormones that are secreted or not secreted by the brain. And so I wanted to look at kind of the physiologic phenomena of it. And the interesting thing is basically after doing this interview with this neuroscientist, the gist of it was, yeah, we don't know. Like, we have no idea. I mean, there's some theories, but like, why is it heat? Why is it, you know, why do you sweat? Why are you cold before and after? Like all the sort of phenomena of hot flashes, I just wanted to take this sort of observational fascination approach. If I can give away the gist, but I don't know if I can use the word. But
oh, wait, there's one word we can't say, Bo.
yes, I'm aware. Okay, so you'll have to go to the book to find out the exact word. But basically the gist of it is that I realized that that maybe if I took a more, since I couldn't find a literal explanation, I tried to create a more metaphorical explanation for what each of these hot flashes was doing. How's that?
Yeah. And it's like, it rhymes with shoot. Well, not rhymes, but it sounds like shoots.
Yes. It's this idea of like, because one of the things that I'd read that from women who had gotten past this phase of their lives was that they felt like they just don't care what anyone thinks. Like there's this freedom of not really being so worried that what anyone thinks of you, and really just living kind of more authentically. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of decided that each of these hot flashes was a step in that direction.
Yes. And so the title of it for everyone out there listening is Burning Up: The Evolution of My Reactions to Hot Flashes. And it's great because you tell it in a series of four pages. And many, I don't know, because I know you said you don't have it in front of you, MK. So correct me, though, if there's better ways to describe it. But it's a series, like the first page is like, basically almost in half, and we see a progression for the main character, you, 1, 2, 3, from confusion, frustration to fascination, how you just explained it to us. And then we see a picture of you at night waking up with your partner and then the dog still asleep. And then we move to the right-hand side. The facing page is a full-page panel where you are representing your interview with Peggy Mason, PhD, professor of neurobiology. and then you turn the page and you've got another full-page panel with your theory. Here's my theory, which is great. And then the facing page of that is a series of, like seven panels where you're kind of marking out the give a shoots, like that you don't give anymore.
Things that are burning off.
And these are burning off. Yeah. And I think it's great how you also have a character of your dog throughout the panels.
Yeah. Dogs have a long tradition in comics as being a bit of a foil.
Why is that? And why? Yeah,
I think it's because dogs make, I mean, if you think about like the history of dogs in comics, like they're always sort of there making some sort of snide reaction or comment. I think it's because they're so non-judgmental, and so we can project onto them anything we want, or we could just use them to sort of reflect on ourselves because they love us unconditionally, you know, but at the same time, you just wonder what they're thinking.
Exactly. It is, and it's the sweetest little face that you have here too. So MK, with this series of comics. Were there any that surprised you when they came in?
Yes, many of them. I think of Linda Berry, who was a great influence on me in my career and the work that I do. If for those of you who might not be familiar with who she is, Linda Berry used to have a weekly comic strip in the kind of alternative newspapers in the U.S. and the U.K. And now actually is at the University of Wisconsin doing some really fascinating work teaching people to draw and make comics as adults as a way to process their lives and their experiences and their thinking. But I had talked to Linda Berry about doing a comic for this collection, and she had said that she was interested. But I also knew she was extremely busy. She had her own book, she had her teaching. And I almost finished the book and turned it in without her contribution. And then one of her former students, who's also in the book, Casey Counselor, said, "No, I really think Linda wants to do a comic for this book." So I had to pressure her, and I was so nervous about it because she's just a real idol of mine. And so it was hard to do, but I did it anyway. And she said, "Yes, absolutely." And I think that her comic really surprised me because it brought in just a perspective that I hadn't thought about, which is this multi-generational perspective. And a couple of the other comics brought this into, like, thinking about reflecting on their own mothers and what their experiences were and how they didn't understand it. And then once you're going through it, you have a whole new kind of consideration of your mother's experience and the other women in your life who have influenced you. And then kind of turning that around to thinking about caring for yourself in a new way, and then thinking about the next generation, perhaps. So the intergenerational piece that came up in a few of the comics really was a great thrill to me.
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned it. I also love Linda Berry, and her book Syllabus is just so, I think, so important and for thinking about how you can teach differently and be more yourself in a classroom even.
Another one that really surprised me was a colleague of mine who's a physician, an emergency medicine physician, but also a cartoonist in Spain. And her comic, her name is Monica Lalanda, and her comic brought up also some intergenerational issues, but also brought up the shame piece that I wanted to get at. And I was just really surprised and thrilled by the way Monica talked about, you know, somehow as if, like, acknowledging that we're going through menopause somehow diminishes one's womanhood or something. And the shame. And she did this fabulous drawing that's what we call a body map, where she kind of divides the body in half and talks about, like, how she feels on the inside, which is perfectly competent, and yet the way that she's judged by society and appealed to by advertisers to, like, fix herself, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to embracing the changes that come with time.
Yes. And that's like, that's coming at, it's like the first, it's in the middle, but in the first half of the book, that's where it's placed. Yeah. When my biological clock stopped ticking.
Yes.
Yeah. As a doctor, as a woman, really women over 45 years old. Yeah. And that half, it is so striking that that full page in half image that you were saying, MK, like what you feel like and then what people project onto you. Although some of it, it does feel like there's a blur with it too, because you do, I don't know, you might not feel like you need to cover the white hairs, but they're definitely springing out of even unexpected places sometimes. Okay. In a different way. That was another one that surprised you. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break. We'll hear, thanks for picking the songs for today's program. And then we'll come back and we'll talk more. Today on the program, M.K. Serwick is here. We've been talking about her book, edited, Menopause, A Comic Treatment. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We've got Jason behind the glass, and we'll be back. Oh. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. Today on the program, M.K. Serwick joins us via phone. Her book, Menopause, A Comic Treatment, what we've got on the table today. Also, let's talk about Graphic Medicine Manifesto and also your book, M.K., Taking Turns, Stories from HIV AIDS Care Unit 371. M.K., thanks for picking the songs for today again. Why did you pick this one?
It started with being on a playlist on Spotify. I think it's called like the Menopause Support Playlist or something that I came across out of curiosity. So it wasn't a song I was super familiar with, but out of those, I wanted to choose the ones that are mostly made by women and who kind of pick up little aspects of the experience, right?
Yeah. I know. I feel like we have girls just want to have fun maybe on deck later, which is also
nice.
A good one. So MK, with I know you now from reading your bio and from reading some of your work. It feels like your life's work is very much about building community, taking care as a caregiver, not only with your own close family, but as a nurse, as a role in the community, as an artist, and in teaching other people how to be cartoonists themselves and to maybe more connect with their own experiences through drawing. When did you start drawing, and were you always drawing when you were a kid, or what was it? How did it happen for you, and why did you keep going?
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually didn't keep going. I was not the kid at school who could draw. I was really good with words. I was an early reader, and I would I really always liked writing, and I would win little essay contests for writing when I was young. And so I thought I wanted to be a writer, and I was convinced to, as much as I enjoyed comics and color and doing all that stuff, I think like many of us, I was encouraged to, you know, put the crayons away, put the markers away, and use my words. And because I was good with those, and I never really developed much skill as a kid in terms of drawing, in terms of multiple dimensions and perspective and all that stuff, that it just made more sense to just leave drawing behind. And it wasn't until words failed me that I had to turn back to drawing. And words failed me when I was working as a new nurse on an inpatient AIDS unit in Chicago at the height of the AIDS crisis in the United States. And I was just day after day, multiple patients that we'd come to know, practically feel like a part of their family because we were such an important part of their support system, and that we would lose all of our patients. We'd watch them suffer profoundly and then lose them. And so I was figuring out as a young nurse, you know, of course they don't teach you how to deal with this in nursing school or medical school, how to deal with that human side. And so I was just trying to figure out, how do I process my own grief so that I can be fully present to the patients I have the next day? When I say words were failing me, what I meant to say is that writing in a journal was just not helpful because in some ways it just felt re-traumatizing. And so I just came into this, I literally stumbled into making a comic, which was that I just drew this little picture of how miserable I felt, and I just wrote the words, "I am miserable," and put a box around it. Mm-hmm. And what I didn't realize was that the space between panels or boxes in a comic represents time. So just in making another box next to that first one, I found myself stumbling into making my first comic, but also it made me take a static state of being miserable and have to do something with it. I had to go somewhere, right?
So it
became something where I just, this combination of image and text in sequential fashion just surprised me. And it took me after 9 panels to a place of hope. And I accomplished basically the function that I needed from this this medium. And then I just kept doing that. And it didn't matter that, you know, I can still to this day, if you look at my work, only draw in like basically 1D, and my perspective is always a struggle. But I can get the work done even in the most basic visual language. And that's another great thing about comics is that, you know, not to denigrate people who are incredibly skilled as artists, but you can also do this work with very basic drawing skills. And it just worked for me. And so then just fast forward, I wanted to keep making comics about this time working on an AIDS unit. And I thought, well, you know, I could learn how to draw better. I could go to art school. But then someone had told me one of the best ways to kind of kill your passion for making and your joy of making art is to go to art school. And that scared me. So I thought, well, what I really want my comics to do to be better is to be informed by theory. And I knew there was a field called narrative medicine, which sort of like the theory of stories and health and well-being and how do stories help us heal and how can, you know, all the ways we mediate different things in our lives are through story. And so if I found some expertise around story, particularly around health, then I thought that would help make my comics better. And so that's what I studied. And then it turned out a few people got in touch with one another, and there were a few other people who kind of wanted to work in this area of like getting comics taken seriously as a tool in healthcare. And that was 15 years ago, maybe a little bit more. And this field has just exploded.
And that was when you mentioned that, MK, do you mean Ian, one of your collaborators on the Graphic Medicine Manifesto?
Yes, yes. He was a physician in at the time he was in Wales, and he was doing the same thing. He was trying to bring together his passion as an artist with his work as a healthcare provider. And he found the way to do that through comics as well. And it turned out there were a lot of people around the world who were doing this sort of thing. They just didn't think it could ever be taken very seriously. And the fact that he coined the term graphic medicine to refer to this intersection of comics and healthcare, and it just kind of, like I said, it's just exploded since then. We've been doing this. I thought I would just get that book done about this AIDS unit I worked on and then just keep making silly comics in my free time and then keep being a nurse. But the truth is I've actually been doing this work full time for 15 years, teaching, traveling, kind of trying to do workshops around this area. It's just taken on a whole second career, which has just been amazing.
And then you also, because you're teaching folks how to process their own experiences or to maybe become more empathetic to others' experiences through drawing and encouraging them not to feel like they can't or embarrassed or ashamed of like what drawings they can make.
Right, right. Because I think once they realize that, like through a few kind of exercises that sort of like really get them engaged in realizing that they actually have all the skills they need to process information, even if you're using something as simple as stick figures, but you can even do better than that. So like, for example, I teach medical students at Northwestern. I get them to just do very simple drawings in crayon in response to prompts around their experience of becoming a doctor, which is actually very stressful emotionally and psychologically.
Yes.
And also, the empathy piece of you can use these exercises in comics, again, in crayon on simple paper to shift perspective and try and see things from the perspective of the patients and the families. And then also, in addition, one of the areas, not just the drawing piece and the making comics, but the reading. So there are actually hundreds of graphic memoirs by adults for adults in a wide variety of diagnosis areas that kind of show what that lived experience of that illness is. So, for example, there's a tremendous book called My Degeneration about what it's like to be diagnosed with and live with Parkinson's disease.
Oh.
If I teach that to a medical student who's already overwhelmed with everything they need to learn, so the medium itself of comics is more enjoyable to engage with, but what they learn along the way through these panels that become windows into the lived experience is a lot more about what that is like for the patient. And again, hopefully to increase this empathy piece so they may ask better informed questions. And in these texts, we see parts of our patients' lives that we're not going to see in a hospital or a clinic.
So are you, MK, are you also working? Because it sounds like you're working with the students maybe who are becoming or might become doctors or are in med school already, maybe also working with physicians. Are you then also working with the patients to help them create these graphic memoirs that you're that you're talking about, like my degeneration, which I'm going to look up.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. Yes, so I have done a few workshops with patients and patient-facing groups on different topics, but I really kind of defer in that area to the work of art therapists, because that's more and more art therapists are a part of our graphic medicine community to kind of think about, you know, they have the expertise to actually kind of provide that therapeutic intervention for someone who's going through something very difficult. Sometimes people make these books about very difficult topics like assault or trauma. And so I think while making a book about something difficult, it's important to be working with a therapist. And so I want to make sure that I'm not having them re-traumatize themselves without the support they would need to go through it.
Well, because you were describing how when you were as a new nurse, being in the Unit 371 during the height of the HIV/AIDS crisis, like how writing for you that had been something in your journal, which is a way you could, it seems like, reliably process and you could go to, you just couldn't anymore. But for you, it felt like drawing was something that was like a game changer, was something pivotal to figure out like a way of expressing or processing. But do you think then for other people, maybe, like, do you think, I know that you can't say MK, but I'm wondering if drawing is something that we can all access in a way, or do you think for some people, maybe they would want like some kind of a journal, like text, you know, alphabetic text would be more something that would be the key to their expression? Or do you think there is something just very different about drawing and that kind of movement in the mind?
I do. I think that it can be complementary. So say their goal as a writer is still traditional text. I think even drawing at the service of their ideas as part of their process can be very productive. I think it takes you places that often might surprise you. Particularly, there's something too about the sequential nature. So a little bit of image, a little bit of text, sequentially, often takes you someplace you might not have gone if you'd only written text alone. And again, everybody's different. I'm not saying this works for everyone, but I have done a lot of workshops with a lot of different groups, and what people find is, and also the other thing for me is I tend to move too fast if I'm just writing text. Like having to represent the elements of a room where something took place makes me focus in on a lot of different things than if I had just described it or just kind of said it happened in this room and moved on, right?
Yeah.
It slows me down and makes me pay attention to certain aspects. And I think that can serve any writer, whether or not you're going to be doing, you know, drawing text and whether or not anyone's ever going to see those drawings. I think it's also part of it's a very productive process piece.
I love that. Let's take a short break and then we'll come back. Again, today on Living Writers, M.K. Serwick is here. The books on the table with us, Menopause, A Comic Treatment, and Graphic Medicine Manifesto. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, M.K. Serwick joins us via telephone. Her book, Menopause, A Comic Treatment, and Graphic Medicine Manifesto. And also, Taking Turns, Stories from HIV/AIDS Care Unit 371. MK. So before this latest break, when we were talking, you were talking about this boom in like graphic medicine, this community coming together, and finding each other, like you're different people doing this work around the world, really, which is exciting.
Yes, absolutely. 1,000%.
And to me, it feels also so important. Like it almost feels like what happened for you, like what you discovered and what you've connected with others, like what they also feel and know to be true and are, you know, now some folks, like two of your, I think, collaborators, co-editors on Graphic Medicine Manifesto, also published in like a publicly a scholarly journal, their studies on this. And so there's a lot happening with this field, and it's turning into something, I don't know, not only big and not only real, but something where you laughed a little bit, where you were like, well, it's not taken seriously, right? Like there was kind of a slight laughter to your voice when you were talking about it. And you said, well, I thought maybe I'd go back to drawing my silly comics. And it's interesting because this is something that feels very, very important and valuable, and it should be taken seriously.
Oh, it's nice to hear you say that. I think, to me, one of the reasons I do this work is that I think that it has the possibility to make difficult situations that we have to endure as human beings a little bit easier. That's one part of it. And then the other reason why I love this work is that, you know, as a young person, my father had multiple strokes and we were his caregiver. And I would notice that when we would be admitted to the hospital after years of taking care of him at home, we knew we were the experts on his care.
Yes.
And yet medical providers, and myself, I'm a nurse, and I always took this into my own practice as a nurse, we feel like, well, we're the authorities, but we're not. We're not the authority on that person. And so what graphic medicine does, especially as these books get published and read, it makes, and especially if we bring them into the systems that educate future healthcare providers,
yes,
it makes the patients and their families have a louder voice in the discussion of what it means to have these particular, or be in these particular situations, right? And even just visually, like, doctors and nurses and medical illustrators were the ones who sort of visually defined what a particular disease looks like. And for the first time, the patients and families are the ones doing it. And for me, that's what's really exciting. It feels a little bit revolutionary.
Yes.
So I love that aspect of this work as well.
And because you can actually see it happening for the patients and their families. Is that right, MK?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, for example, I run a workshop with adults who are thinking about end-of-life planning, right? Advanced, what we call advanced directives. Like, if you were able to have agency in the way that your life were to end, what's important to you, and what are your values in that situation? What would you like your family to know? Those are hard conversations to have.
Yes.
And yet, people. So I have this exercise where I give adults who have never drawn before, at least as adults, perhaps, paper and crayons, and I say, draw a good death. Draw your, you know, what you think of as a good death. And those drawings and the conversations we have around them actually are a huge way to sort of take agency over a situation in which they may or may not have much agency, right? And to share with their family and their loved ones what their values are. You know, where am I? Who's there? Who's not there? What kind of situation am I in? Is there music? Is there nature? Is that, you know, all of the things that, you know, you think might be important to someone at that time or in difficult times, their families can kind of take, just by having to visually represent it, they can think about it in a new way.
And hearing you talk about it, MK, as well, that was so helpful because when you said that, I was like, I don't know what that would look like. Like, do people draw usually like a room, a space, or do they draw something that looks like the cells or the inside of their body? Or because I didn't know at first what to draw a good death, what that could mean. And then when you were describing, oh, is there, who's in the room, or is it outside, is it in nature, or is it music? Yeah. What do you find, people draw all sorts of things, or?
Yeah. Usually it's a room of some sort. It's very interesting to hear you say about the kind of like internal, thinking about cells and the internal experience. That's interesting. I haven't had anyone draw that, but yeah, so people draw like a room usually. Often it's a room in their home, or sometimes it's not, because in drawing it, they realize like, wait, I don't want this to happen in my house. I want to be, you know, in a nice, comfortable place that's different. Or I've had someone draw being in outer space, you know, so just sometimes they're fantastical. Sometimes they're very realistic. But in general, no matter what they draw, the conversations that we have around them, have moved them closer to being able to talk about this with their family, and also like kind of realizing for themselves what their thoughts and feelings are. And I remember I had one woman who said, you know, just give this, I'm just going to give this drawing to my daughter and say, like, get me as close to this as you can, you know?
Right. That's what I was going to ask. And some of them probably, some people will say, I'm going to show this picture and this will get the conversation started. Or this person was like, this is an illustration for you.
Exactly. And like I said, in the process of doing it, they realize, you know, I don't think my sister could handle this, so maybe we don't tell her till later or whatever, right? Like, they can have those conversations. And those things change as one progresses in their life, but it's good to have sort of at this point, at this moment in time in my life, this is what I'm thinking, right?
Are you, MK, are you working on a book now? Your current work or what? Yeah.
I publish a few chapters in different anthologies, and I do projects as they come up with other people. I love working collaboratively. The current book that I'm working on, that I'm just getting started on, is actually about moral development. Like, what was just telling some stories through the course of my life that helped lead me to what I think is my particular moral compass. And my goal in doing this is to just sort of model what, just the idea of examining, like, what shaped my, you know, for a reader and for anyone who's interested, like, how do the events that happen in our life shape how we make decisions? And I think in the end, it's ultimately about end of life and kind of what is the good death, what is the good life, like, examining those concepts in theory, but also in, like, formative events throughout one's life.
That's why I was asking you, actually, because I wondered if your next work was kind of looking at that more closely.
Yeah, it was inspired by, you know, having obviously done this professionally, but then also like rising to the challenge of doing it personally. So for my mother and my aunt, kind of, you know, what did it mean for them to have, what did a good death mean to them? Because they were fortunate enough to live late into their life in their 90s. And it was very different for each of them. And you know, I once heard someone say, and I think this is very true as I've lived it, like, orchestrating a good death is very difficult. It's like trying to orchestrate a beautiful birth experience. Like, things just go awry. And it takes a lot of energy from a large community to kind of make it be what's safest and best and most calming for the person at the center of it. And so I wanted to kind of think about all of that stuff as well.
And so for you, it comes down to something with, you know, you say moral compass, MK. Is that something connected then that you think about spirituality, or is it something that's directly connected for you with your creativity?
Yeah, all of the above. I think, yeah, you know, and mostly I'm really trying to just have an exercise in examining all these things and just sort of seeing, like, you know, I've got an outline of what the book will be, but I haven't started actually drawing it. And I'm real curious, like I said, with all of these exercises, where it takes me, like, what will it reveal to me?
Oh, so are you going to do some of the exercises that you have in your workshop yourself or so?
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely, like, I spent the last year teaching how to make comics to medical illustrators, and it really made me have to sort of think about what does the medium do differently than just being able to draw, you know, accurate representations of organs and procedures, and how, and so I've done a lot of work to teach that course, which I'm now turning everything I learned back towards hopefully the next book that I do.
So So if someone really, because I would imagine the people who are in that particular classroom that you just mentioned, they are very accomplished at drawing, at perspective. They probably know all the terms and have like a nice set of, composing tools. What is it like to see someone who has such a great hold on like creating visual elements, but how they start interacting with stories and finding, because is it often that you're trying to have them connect to their own stories or to find other people's stories as a way to then build a scene that has an arc?
Yeah, both. It's both, right? So they definitely, because modern medical education and modern medical kind of communication often does benefit from having narrative skills, right? So that they have been taught like those skills. But yeah, a lot of times what I'm bringing to them is, what does this medium particularly do? And what are the advantages and benefits that they could have using this medium? So we covered different aspects of graphic medicine. So as an educational intervention, as a reflective tool, as a research, it has some great applications to research. And then also as like a way of thinking about advocacy, like health advocacy, like how could we, you know, we all know that like sometimes a really convincing story will help us think about something a different way and maybe advocate for some change. And so that's one of the ways we talk about using this work as well.
Mm. And earlier you mentioned with some of your other students, I'm not sure, I think it was more in a workshop setting, you bring out crayons for them in their exercises. What is it about the crayon that you like? Is it the playfulness of it, or is it that it makes it more clearly low stakes, or?
Yes, all of the above. Yes, it's absolutely. I think that the smell of a new box of crayons just takes us back to a time when we knew what we got out of drawing, right? We knew why we were doing it, and we enjoyed it. There's joy there. And so I want to bring that piece. And even at the service of a difficult topic, like what is a good death, right? There's something about using crayons. And then also, the stakes are lower, right? No one's expected to do a representational drawing with crayons. And we know that we've got crayons, so that sort of limits that area. And then I just love colors, and so I think it's just fun to do work in color. Now, sometimes people will just use the black crayon or just the green or whatever, but it also, we have that choice. And so, you know, I always say you're the artist, you make all the choices, and so it's nice to have that full range of choices in front of us. But yeah, that's my chapter in the Graphic Medicine Manifesto is called The Crayon Revolution, because I think that adults should start working with crayons.
I love that. Okay, so adults working with crayons. I'm gonna, you know what? I've got lots of colored pens right now, but I think I'm gonna go, and Sharpies, but I think I'm gonna pick up some crayons. You've definitely inspired me today with the conversation. So when you all, let's look at Graphic Medicine Manifesto. This book that folks can get as well. Why was it important to use the word manifesto for your group?
Yeah. One of the reviewers wasn't comfortable with that word, but I felt like it was really about like putting a stake in the ground to say, no, comics should be taken seriously. And here are each of these authors is going to give you a chapter on why they believe that to be true and how they're using comics in their work. And so, that manifesto was like, you know, Ian even draws it in the introduction, which is in comic form. Of, you know, tacking it to the door of like, take comics seriously.
Yes.
And yeah.
Yeah. What did they want you to call it?
I don't know. Yeah. This is graphic medicine or something.
Yeah. Right. No, I loved it. As soon as I saw that, I was like, this is happening. This is happening. Yeah. And in the introduction, it says, so too, graphic medicine resists the notion of the universal patient and vividly represents multiple subjects with valid and at times conflicting points of view and experiences.
Yes. And that's to counter this idea of like the Parkinson's patient or the cancer patient or the, you know, diabetic, right? Like this notion that it's a monolith of like all patients who have this particular condition are the same or somehow, which is ridiculous, right? Because everyone's different. And that's exactly what he's saying is there is, I think that, you know, one of the things we also didn't wanted to do in that book is to put out sort of the principles or kind of what we believe to be true as we get this movement off the ground, that, yeah, that every patient should be seen as an individual. And sometimes we as humans are internally conflict. You know, we contain multitudes, right? So
yes.
we can say I'm really angry, but I'm happy all at the same time on the same topic, right? And I think that comics in some ways do that just by their nature of using image and text in sequential form. Like we can represent, or like, for example, one of the ways I love to talk about comics in a healthcare context is, you know, drawing a interaction between a doctor and a patient. Often, you know, the words in the speech bubble can be very different than the thoughts in the thought bubble on both sides of that encounter, right?
Right. Right.
Like, that's... you know, as the patient, I'm thinking like, am I going to die? But what I'm saying out loud is like, so I guess I'm doing okay then, right?
Right. Right. Exactly. And it can be, both things are true.
Yep.
And what you are describing, MK, is exactly like the experience for me of also reading Menopause, A Comic Treatment. Like, that's what's captured there, that there's so many individual and various experiences with people coming from all different like positionalities, like, and ages, and, you know, but there's things that we can all share as a community because it's something that you are going through and experiencing.
Right, right. Well, I appreciate you saying that.
Well, I appreciate you making these books and for all your work. And you, because also, do you want to say a word, like we're reaching the end of our time, but a word about your website for people to come to for graphic medicine also, and comicsnurse.com?
Oh, I appreciate that. Right. So if you want to learn more about graphic medicine, we have a website, graphicmedicine.org. And it's basically meant to be a hub for all of the, as many as we can catalog on the website, the activities in this area. There is a search bar on the right of the website in case there's an area that you're interested in. You want to search what's out there. If you don't find something and you're still wondering, feel free to email us through the site. And my website, comicnurse.com, tells you more about the book. There's some audio from the interviews I did for Taking Turns you can listen to. You can just kind of explore that and see some of the other work that's been going on in this area. But mostly it just exists as sort of an online way for people to learn more about what I do.
MK, thank you so much. Thank you for what you do and what you draw.
Oh, and thank you for taking the time to be interested and talk with me. I do appreciate it.
Oh my gosh. MK, anytime, come back to Living Writers anytime. And thanks to everyone out there for listening. Thanks very, very much to MK Serwick for being here today via phone. Her book, Menopause, A Comic Treatment, also Graphic Medicine Manifesto, also Taking Turns, Stories from HIV AIDS Care Unit 371. Thanks to Jason for engineering. Thanks all of you out there for listening. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
WCBN-FM Ann Arbor Archives. Original air date July 21, 2017 at 9 a.m. Just go away.